Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1PLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'll bring for you today in digest format CQ Magazine for March 2010. CQ is a publication of CQ Communications, Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editor is Richard Mawson, W2VU. This recording is a production of the Courage Handyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website, www.handyham.org. Let's begin the readings today with ham radio news. Earthquake in Haiti. Ham radio was able to play only a limited role in getting communications into and out of Haiti in the immediate aftermath of the massive earthquake there in January. This was due primarily to the small number of resident amateurs. Ham activity by relief organizations appears to be picking up at press time. Call KI6SN has early information in his public service column this month and will follow up in future issues as developments warrant. ARRL elects first female president. The American Radio Relay League Board of Directors in January elected first Vice President Kay Craigie, N3KN, as the organization's new president, succeeding Joel Harrison, W5ZN, who did not seek re-election. Craigie is the first woman to hold the league's top position. According to the ARRL letter, Rick Roderick, K5UR, is the new first vice president. Midwest Division Director Bruce Fromm, K0PJ, was elected an additional vice president, and Dakota Division Director Jay Bellows, K0QB, is the new vice president for international affairs. Their respective vice directors moved up to the director's seats, and Craigie will appoint new vice directors. In addition, Technical Relations Manager Brennan Price, N4QX, was named ARRL Chief Technology Officer. W7HAS, in charge of federal computer security. Howard Schmidt, W7HAS, has been named White House Cybersecurity Coordinator by President Obama. According to the White House, he is one of the world's leading authorities on computer security and will be a key member of the President's National Security Staff. Schmidt told the ARRL that amateur radio got him started in the world of computing. A former police officer and computer security advisor to the FBI and the Department of Defense, Newsline reports Schmidt has also worked in the private sector at eBay and as Microsoft's first chief security officer. CQ columnist K4TWJ, Silent Key. Dave Ingram, K4TWJ, a CQ columnist for nearly 30 years, passed away in January 20 as a result of complications from a massive heart attack that he suffered on New Year's Eve. Dave was best known for his monthly World of Ideas column. He also wrote CQ's How It Works and QRP, which was the low power columns. His family asks that any contributions in his memory be made to the American Heart Association. KI6SN, named editor of World Radio Online. We just heard that call a few moments ago. Richard Fisher, KI6SN of Riverside, California, has been named editor of World Radio Online magazine, succeeding Nancy Cott, WZHC, who resigned. A veteran journalist and writer, Fisher is already familiar to many readers of CQ publications. He is CQ's public service editor and writes the trail-friendly radio column in WRO as well as the Washington Beat column in Popular Communications. He plans to continue writing those columns in addition to his editing duties. Fisher takes up the reins of World Radio Online as of the magazine's April issue. Janikowski looking to reboot the FCC. FCC Chairman Julius Grondakowski is asking for input on ways to improve the functioning of the government's main communications regulatory agency. According to Newsline, Grondakowski has set up a website called reboot.fcc.gov and is seeking suggestions from the public on how the Federal Communications Commission can better serve the American people. Hamvention, sticking with Hara. The Dayton Amateur Radio Association says that the annual Dayton Hamvention will remain at Hara Arena for at least the next 3 years. Organizers of the world's largest hamfest have reached an agreement to keep the event in place at least through 2013. Nominations are open for Dayton's annual awards, the Amateur of the Year, Special Achievement, and Technical Excellence Awards, and are due in by March 15th. For information about that, you can see the DARA website at www.hamvention.org. North Korea remains at the top of most wanted lists. The DX Magazine's annual Most Wanted Countries list is out with North Korea, the prefix is a P5, Papa 5, remaining at the top for yet another year. Major de-expeditions to Daejeo Island, K5D, and Willis Island, VK9/W, knocked both of those entities from near the top of the list clear out of the top 100 DXCC entities needed by the world's DXers. Rounding out the top five worldwide for 2009 are Navassa Island, KP1, Marion Island, ZS8, Bovet, 3Y/B, and Yemen, YO. For additional listings and regional breakdowns, see the January-February 2010 issue of the DX Magazine. Mars gets a new name and a new mission. The military affiliate radio system has been renamed the Military Auxiliary Radio System by the Department of Defense, and given a new primary role in providing backup communications to the military and to civil authorities at all levels of government. The new instruction, the first major revision of the Mars mission in over 20 years, also lays to rest fears that Navy Marine Corps Mars might be eliminated. Ham ranks keep growing. The ARRL/VEC reports that more than 30,000 new people entered the amateur radio service in 2009, nearly double the number of new hams who joined the fraternity 5 years earlier. The numbers have been climbing steadily since 2005, when only 16,000 newcomers joined our ranks, hitting 21,000 in 2006, nearly 27,000 in 2007, and 28,000. In 2008. Overall, more than 122,000 new people have become hams in the past 5 years. Not bad for a hobby that some of us continue to insist is dying. We have a couple of more ham radio news announcements. New tech class question pool release. The National Conference of Volunteer Examiner Coordinators, NCVEC, has released a new pool of questions from which technician class license exams will be assembled for the next 4 years. The new pool contains roughly 400 questions, of which 35 will be selected for each tech exam. For the first time since volunteer examining began in the 1980s, the Element 2 exam will contain questions based on graphics and diagrams. These questions will be used between July 1, 2010 and June 30, 2014. And the last news item in the CQ for March of 2010 is about our system, the Handy Ham system, moving to a new home. The headquarters of the Courage Handy Ham system has moved from the main Courage Center complex in Golden Valley, Minnesota, a Minneapolis suburb, to Camp Courage in rural Maple Lake, about 45 miles away. The move appears to be part of an overall move by Courage Center in the wake of the nationwide downturn in philanthropic giving to concentrate more of its resources on its core Rehabilitation Services. For more information about that, you can go to www.handyham.org. And remember, Handy Ham, in our case, is always spelled lowercase, one word, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M. So that's www.handyham.org. Now let's first go to the results of the 2009 CQ Worldwide WPX CW contest. CW, of course, is Morse code. The contributing author for this information is Randy Thompson, K5ZD. Now, folks, as I oftentimes state, I'm only going to give you sort of the introductory commentary by the author because it's a very long, very comprehensively put together report on that contest, the CQ Worldwide WPXCW contest back in 2009. So if you've been participating in those contests over the years, or if only just the right recent one, go to the 2010 March issue of CQ Magazine, and if you can't read it, have someone come along and help you read it again yourself, just so you might find out where you are on there, if indeed you did make some good points. The 51st running of the WPXCW contest on May 30, 2009 fell on a rare fifth weekend in the month of May. This moved the contest away from its usual conflict with the bank holidays in Europe and the Memorial Day holiday in the United States, enabling many contesters to participate without having to share their time with holiday or family activities. The result was a record number 3,649 log submissions and 44 new world or continent records. Big scores result from big multipliers. The multi-operator team of UU7J surpassed all others with 1,311 prefixes, just too short of the all-time record set by DR1A last year. They were followed by WE3C with 1,274 and NR4M with 1,267. Among the single operators, the top prefix hunters were CU2X with 1,066 and VY2TT with 1,054. There were 60 entries with 1,000 or more prefix multipliers, almost double last year. Conditions were much better than for the WPX single sideband contest. Some participants reported conditions as only being fair, while others raved about excellent over-the-pole openings. UP2L worked 940 North American stations on 20 meters, a direct pole path from Kazakhstan. Sporadic E provided excitement on both 10 and 15 meters, with double and triple hop contacts providing score-boosting DX contacts. KD4D reported 21 contacts with Europe on 10 meters. The low bands experienced QRN, that's a lot of noise, in both Europe and North America. Top band winner LY2IJ was only able to work 15 stations outside Europe. Many competitors find it helpful to set a goal for their operation. KH7XS had high expectations with his goal to, quoting, break the old oceanic record set near the top of the last solar cycle, close quote. He did it by a comfortable margin. N1LN defined his efforts from NC4KW very clearly, quoting again, goal one was to make 1 million points. Goal 2 was to lock 1,000 QSOs. Close quote. Mission accomplished. NG7Z's goal were more modest. Break 200 QSOs and get at least one contact on every band. He did it in less than 5 hours of operating time. Regardless of goals or expectations, WO1N was probably not the only one to feel, quoting again, a bit of contester's remorse. When it was over, I was bummed I didn't spend more time, close quote. Not everyone in the contest was measuring their success by the numbers. For KE1HA, quoting, this was my first CW contest ever, close quote. The multi-op team at NM7D reported, we all had fun and learned a lot in our first try at this operation. KL8DX summed it up this way. limited time, but unlimited fun. And then the article goes on to talk about single operators, all bands, all band, low power, and so forth. It's very, very well done by the author. Let's take a quick look at some of the announcements in the magazine for March 2010, this month. The following special event stations are scheduled for early April. N4C, from the 38th Annual Raleigh, North Carolina Hamfest and ARRL State Convention in Raleigh, North Carolina. Now, the Hamfest's slated for March, which happens to be today, March 1st, 2010, March 13 and 14, 2010 Charlotte Hamfest, Cabrera's Arena and Events Center, Concord, New Hampshire. On the 20th, Charleston, West Virginia Hamfest, Coonskin Armory, Charleston, West Virginia. Also on the 20th, the Middle Tennessee ARS Hamfest. It's at the First Methodist Church Center in Tullahoma, Tennessee. On the 21st, Kuntukcook Valley Radio Club Hamfest. Try saying that five times fast, folks. Kuntukcook. That one's at the Hanneker Community School in Hanneker, New Hampshire. On the 27th, Columbus, Indiana, ARC Hamfest, Bartholomew County 4-H Fairgrounds, southwest of Columbus, Indiana. And talk about big Hamfest. On April 3 through 5, China, International Ham Radio 2010 Expo and Festival. That's being offered by Intex in Shanghai, China. April 16 through 18, the 61st Annual International DX Convention. It's at the Holiday Inn Hotel and Conference Center, Visalia, California. You know, just thinking, as I'm getting ready to turn the page to a next piece, some of you snowbirds that have been way down south there in Florida or wherever and are working your way back in your trailers or in your cars might want to catch one of these hamfests in Charleston or Tennessee on the way home. Not a bad idea. There's a new entry into the ham radio transceiver market. It's a unique receiver circuit gizmo that gets the once-over and a thumbs-up from Gordo. That's Gordon West, WB6NOA. This CQ review is for the Jetstream JT-220M, JT-220M, 222 megahertz, 50-watt mobile. It is good to see new manufacturers entering the ham radio transceiver market. The new entry product may be something entirely new, a product that takes up where another manufacturer stopped, or a product price substantially lower than the competition, hoping to get into the ham transceiver marketplace. The new entry is best launched by a marketing expert well established within the ham radio industry. This is exactly how Jetstream enters the ham transceiver market with its 50-watt, 220 megahertz mobile radio, with marketing direction from Evelyn Garrison, WS7A. Evelyn is one of the ham industry's pioneers in innovative marketing strategies, having directed amateur radio sales at ICOM America, Alinco, and now Jetstream. Evelyn points out that even though Jetstream is not yet a household name among hams, something she aims to change, the Ohio-based company has actually been in business for 15 years. Focusing until now on antenna and accessories, as well as private label products that bear a retailer's brand name, it wasn't until last year's Dayton Hamvention that I realized how many products Jetstream was offering. Here's a note of some of them. Dual band and tri-band VHF, UHF, fiberglass based antennas, scanner disc cones, coax cable and coax switches, fan dipoles, a full line of power supplies including repeater battery backup supplies, cross needle SWR bridges and speakers, and now, here we go, a new 50-watt, 99-channel, 222 megahertz FM mobile radio, the JT220M. Actually, the JT220M is a mobile OR base station using one of Jetstream's power supplies and its JTB5 tri-band base antenna for 144, 222, and 446, or the power supply in the antenna of your choice, of course. The radio is manufactured in China, and while we've all heard stories about quality issues with Chinese radios, Evelyn says the person in charge of manufacturing the JT220M is someone with whom she has worked for more than 30 years while at both ICOM and Alliance, and that she has full confidence in the quality and workmanship behind this transceiver. This mobile is no lightweight. It weighs over 2.5 pounds, with most of the weight in the heavy upper and rear heatsink. The 10-foot power cord will get you into the engine compartment for a direct battery or near battery hookup. We measure nearly 10 amps on transmit, and you don't want to continuously pull this much current through an accessory socket in the mobile. If you are paying the money for a high-power 222 megahertz mobile, go directly to the battery for a full 50 watts out. Our testing was first conducted on the bench, and there are enough repeaters on 222 megahertz here in Southern California to judge voice quality and transmit, as well as distant repeaters and simplex receiver capabilities. We had no problem with 50 watts output, and our IFR gave us 0.25 UV, 12 dB SINAD, nice and hot sensitivity, dual conversion, although we seldom had much interference on this band, even in Southern California. Now, looking at the frequency selection, you can dial in specific frequency information, or you can program the 50-watt mobile from Jetstream software, an optional programming cable. Memory channel readout is either alphanumeric or bifrequency, your choice for each memory channel. However, if you're a new ham, or other hams are likely to use your rig, don't become too dependent on the alphanumerics. During the recent California wildfires, many new hams with alphanumeric on their displays were stymied when told to go to a specific frequency, such as 446 megahertz simplex, as they had no idea where to find it in alphanumeric memory. With regard to the online performance, transmit is unique. The microphone push-to-talk goes click, letting you know you are transmitting. And when released, the transmitter drops audio, but remains keyed up for about 500 milliseconds. The sound on the air would be a clunk, similar to some Radio Shack sets you might hear on the 2-meter band. This could slow things down a bit in the fast-paced net operation, but should not pose a problem in any other setting. Everyone gave us excellent signal reports. The microphone cord was ultra-heavy. The backlit keypad on the mic itself was easy to see at night. There were up-down buttons to change the channels or frequencies, a switch to lock out DTMF, and a lock button that locks the keypad, but does not lock the up-down buttons. Since the 222 MHz band is usually a next band to do for operators already on 2 meters and 440, those operators have a good idea regarding mobile radio program features and splits and will quickly understand the operation of the Jetstream 222 MHz gear. It was seen selling for an average price of about $245, on a par with the only other single-band 222 MHz transceiver currently on the market, the 25-watt DR235MK2 from Alliance. You'll find additional company on the band from folks who have 222 MHz handhelds from Alliance, Kenwood, and Yaesu. It is quite a radio, and with Evelyn Garrison's backing, the future for Jetstream looks good. Quoting, Jetstream is working hard to have quality products at great prices. We feel we are never done and are always striving to improve on existing products and continue to introduce more items, including additional transceivers. We have over 100 years of combined experience in the amateur radio industry, stated Evelyn. For more information on the complete line of Jetline products and the dealer listing, you can go to www.jetstream-usa.com. That's www.jetstream-usa.com. Don't forget the dash in there, jetstream-usa.com. And you can also email them to sales@jetstream-usa.com. Moving along now to World of Ideas. The author here is Dave Ingram, K4TWJ. Unfortunately, we just read Dave's silent key announcement at the beginning of this recording. But let's hear what he had to say in this writing. Hamming from the Shadows, because it's part 8. There may not be a part 9, of course. Your interest in our previous Hamming from the Shadows series in CQ continues to grow, indicating we are filling a definite need and addressing an area of widespread concern. That makes sense, as more and more people are living in confined spaces, and modern consumer-installed TVs, surround sound systems, stereos, etc., are noticeably more susceptible to RFI than those simple-to-connect electronic setups of past times. Discouraged by the combined results, a number of radio amateurs have downsized to using only a 2-meter or dual-band FM handy talkie for hamming. Once again, I say, don't give up. Amateur radio is one of the world's greatest hobbies and pursuits, and our gold-spanning HF bands, that's high-frequency bands, are the glitz and glamour area we need to experience firsthand to fully appreciate it. Looking at good station photos in radio magazines may give you the impression that everyone on high-frequency HF has a super-tall tower and monster antenna system, but such is not the case. Many amateurs, and I emphasize many amateurs, are having a ball QSOing friends and working the world using only a 100-watt HF transceiver and a vertical or horizontal wire antenna. You can do it too. Remember, where there is a will, there is a way. Need more thought-wetting ideas and encouragement? Read on. Let's talk about radiating gutters. I've been thinking about that, folks. Let's see what Dave has to say. After highlighting the house gutter antenna used by Jeff, K8CQ, in last year's Shadows column, Dave Winkle, WA8KOQ, stepped up and reported using a similar setup with good results. Thinking back a few years, I recall several other friends using gutter antennas. Apparently, loading up the old metal gutter is a popular secret solution for amateurs living in ridiculously restricted areas. Don't sneer. When we briefly lived in a townhouse several years ago, I gamma-matched and loaded up our second-story metal bed frame on 17 meters and worked stations coast-to-coast and some DX with it. Details of Wink's invisible antenna and rigs are shown in different photos in this article. An SGC-239 auto-tuner is installed at the feed point, and a pair of radios alongside the house serves as a ground system. Initially, Wink used the left side downspout and gutter to the base of the roof peak, about 11 feet plus 26 feet or 37 feet in total, and found it worked quite well. A couple of years later, he added a 16-foot strip of wire along the roof peak and connected it to the 16-foot gutter plus 11-foot downspout on the right side of the house. Wink reports the resultant 80-foot antenna with the SGC-239 tuner at the base works 160 through 10 meters and outperforms all the indoor antennas he has ever tried. There are some good lessons here. Outdoor antennas, even those comprised of thin wire with buttons for insulators and clear nylon fishing line, beat dipoles strung indoors around the room. The radiation pattern resulting from bent to fit available space or supports. Antennas may be distorted, but it works, and a distorted pattern antenna beats no antenna. A low gutter antenna may have a high angle of radiation. In translation, that means better for close-up rather than far-out QSOs. But low-angle radiation from the vertical downspouts can take up the slack. Limited room for a large 130-foot doublet or horizontal loop antenna? Use insulated wire placed around roof edges and zigzag toward the roof middle as necessary. Thanks a lot to Wink, WA8KOQ, for sharing his views of his hidden antenna. Dave Ingram continues with a hamming from Fantasyland in this same article. Now looking in the opposite direction, Howard Hawkins, a K6BYU, enjoys hamming from the shadows of one of the most elaborate undercover antenna farms we have seen. There are lots of photographs here, folks. Living amid strictly encoded CCNRs, Howard has a 28-foot-tall flagpole vertical with 80 radials, a G5 RFE on a 32-foot fiberglass mast, and a 43-foot 05 vertical, and a two-element step IR beam on a motor race 50-foot tower. Howard's indoor setup is capable of running full legal power, and he says RFI is not a problem. His elaborate 80 radial ground system and buried in conduit coaxial cables obviously help to ensure radiation is confined to the antenna proper. We also note neighboring houses are a fair distance from Howard's antenna, and his house is situated above street level and peppered with foliage, so spotting anything inside the fenced back area without being considered a prowler is difficult. The 28-foot flagpole was considered patriotic and approved by the Neighborhood Homeowners Association. Howard installed its base radial plate, radials, coax, and feed line below ground level, and even added a drainage system with a base of rocks, so no one realized it was a vertical. Howard says the vertical is his main antenna because it blends with the landscape and is always up and ready to use. The G5 RV is supported by a 32-foot fiberglass mast that Howard lies flat on the ground and or raises or lowers as required. Several companies, for instance MFJ, DX Engineering, 05, and possibly others, are producing 43-foot verticals, and all the reports on them I have heard have been very good. Howard says this vertical is made by www.05-antennas.com. It's connected to the flagpole's 80 radial system, and it is light enough so that he can quickly raise and lower it as needed. He often serves as NCS, net control station, for a 40-meter net, and net members consistently rate the 05 several dBs above his flagpole or G5 RV. The antenna is painted a sky blue color, so it blends with its background, and it lies flat on the ground, undetected inside his gated back area, when the rig is not in use. The biggest surprise at the CCNR-restricted QTH of K6BYU is the two-element step IR Yagi on a power-raised force 12 tower. The beam and tower nest amidst foliage at 12 feet and pass unnoticed to untrained eyes, and then quickly rise to 50 feet at the push of a button. The antenna also spends much of its life nested, which blends with the most non-retired amateur's career-oriented lifestyle. That is, most daytime hours are devoted to business, career, pursuits, and only night hours are free for hamming. A special thanks to Howard K6BYU for sharing details of his low-profile setup. Now, how about some shadow talk? A number of friends say they follow my Hamming from the Shadows series here in CQ Magazine in hopes of acquiring one or two ideas they too can use for uncovering hamming. Jolly good. Once again, however, I must emphasize that one idea or solution does not necessarily fit all circumstances. But seeing how others have overcome the handicaps gives all of us hope and inspiration. Combine that with some helpful notes to kindle your own thoughts and creative thinking, plus some tips for minimizing RFI, radio frequency interference, and presenting a good neighbor attitude, and your odds for success increase tenfold. Let's cite some examples. Your available area for installing a dipole may be limited, but folding each side or element as illustrated in Figure 2 here may be a previously unrealized solution. The resultant radiation pattern may not be ideal, but it works, and it definitely beats no radiation pattern and no on-air operations. Going mobile or routing a roll-up coaxial cable or an AC extension cord to your vehicle's mobile setup is another alternative worth pursuing. Look back in November 2009 CQ. on pages 13, 14, and 16. And you can read about how K7FF, Kilo 7 Fox Fox, had a ball in the 2008 CQ Worldwide DX contest using an FT-450AT and tall whip from his truck that he parked in an open field adjacent to his apartment complex. He used a couple of externally charged batteries for a full weekend hamming and hopped back home for bed and breakfast breaks. Expanding on that idea, I visualize installing a really tall and a snap-together vertical or a super antennas, snap-together mini beam on a tilt mount in the truck bed. That would give it almost home rig clout. And being independent of home or apartment fixtures should skirt CC&R entanglements. My apologies for suggesting such naughty but clever ideas. Finally, remember diplomacy and standing ready to assist your community when needed are invaluable assets. When I moved to a near coastal area 5 years ago, I ended up teaching the local power company why and how to find and fix power line noise. When I moved back to central Alabama a year later, my budget necessitated moving into a gated community with a 200-page book of CC&Rs. Hi. I explained the benefits of having a ham with emergency and global communications capabilities in a community, get pictures of my neatly installed vertical, and described my plan for making it transparent to untrained eyes, and I also hid my prized crank-up tower under the house. After moving in, I held output power to 100 watts, met neighbors, and, unbeknownst to them, evaluated their electronic appliances from the susceptible to RFI standpoints. I even sneakily added clamp-on toroids to cable TV distribution lines as a safekeeping measure to avoid TV eye. A little later, I began using my occasional maximum power of 500 watts and continue holding at that maximum level today. I am also literally working the world with 100 to 500 watts. Prefix XU, 3B8, 9K2, VK, ZL, and more. A couple of months ago, vicious QRM, that's noise, almost annihilated my DXcapades. I drove around the community checking with my mobile rig and narrowed the source to a neighbor's house. I then introduced myself and explained the arcing from within could be a fire hazard. The neighbor asked what to do, so I sequentially switched off each of the house circuit breakers and found the culprit was a 220-volt arcing heater contactor lying on a piece of dry carpet. A fire waiting to happen. The lady had a contactor replaced, and I hailed as a hero in the community's next month's bulletin. Hopefully, that will help justify my vertical antenna's existence. But I continue to look for an alternate QTH location, just in case the old knife-in-back syndrome surfaces. In conclusion, that overflows column space for this month, friends, but more views and tales of amateurs successfully hamming from the shadows, plus more tips on staying low profile, that is to say, avoiding discovery, are coming soon. Watch for them, and do whatever you need to do to keep on hamming. 73, Dave, K4TWJ. Folks, this is Bob Zeta, your reader, N1BLF. I want to remind you again that this gentleman, Dave Ingram, K4TWJ, is now a silent key. He passed away on January 20 of 2010, a couple of months ago. Whether or not there is another column still in the system that may be printed, perhaps in April or May, I don't know. But we respectfully appreciate and enjoy the work that this gentleman has done in his lifetime for amateur radio. We thank you very much, Dave Ingram, K4TWJ, Silent Key. As we continue looking at and reading in a digest format, the CQ Magazine for March 2010, here on the Courage Handy Ham System, we'll go to contesting. The author here is John Dorr, spelled D-O-R-R. John's call is K1AR, Kilo 1 Alpha Romeo. He calls this one CQ Contest, CQ Contest, CQ Contest. Now, if you're a ham radio operator already, how many times have you said that little catchy phrase over the airwaves? March's contest tip. Passing needed multipliers from one band to another is both an art form and an aggressive sport. The fundamental secret to success, however, is to ask another station in a way that makes it sound like you really mean it. For example, instead of saying, "Can you go to 40 meters?" frame the question to be, "Thanks. Let's now QSY to 7145, okay?" Being more specific and convincing is an important element in the successful pass. Also, don't be limited by the fear of rejection. Not everyone can or will move for you. You can be guaranteed, however, that the other station won't QSY if you don't ask, and especially if you take a lax approach. Give it a try. Now for the text. It's 2359 Zulu, and the anticipation of yet another exciting XYZ contest has reached its peak. You may not have the biggest station in the world, but you've at least completed as much preparation as possible. For once, you've actually tested your computer software ahead of time. Even your voice recording hardware is working and pre-programmed. The coffee is brewing along with the steaming crock pot full of beef stew. This is contesting as we know it. Suddenly, the clock turns over to 0000 Zulu. The contest has begun. As a smaller station, you choose a strategy that begins by searching and pouncing up and down the bands. This is probably an approach taken by most participants in a major contest, and it can be quite effective. Careful tuning, combined with judicious use of a second radio, can really maximize your start in any contest, especially as a smaller station. What I have been characterizing so far is missing one key element. In many contests, one can start at 14150.2, that's a frequency, and move up to the other end of the band and find station after station calling CQ, especially when the band is wide open. Some of them are DX stations in South America or the Caribbean working guys at incredible rates. Others are North American operators endlessly calling CQ with only an occasional answer. And this phenomenon is not limited to only DX contacts. The ARRL sweepstakes, for example, can often demonstrate similar characteristics. Unless I've missed something, there are no contest rules that disallow discretionary CQing. If you want to park your VFO at 28.995 kHz for the entire 48 hours of a DX contest, calling CQ the entire time, that's your prerogative. Lately, however, there seems to be more debate about excessive CQing in contests, so let's unpack the topic a little more. Who are the predominant CQers these days? Well, it used to be an exclusive club that included mostly the large multi-multi and multi-single stations from around the world. However, in recent years, it seems that something has changed dramatically. More and more operators have become increasingly aggressive with their use of the CQing operating tool. Why is that? Well, for starters, there are simply more stations to work. From a U.S. perspective, especially the East Coast, a number of European participants in a DX contest, such as the CQ Worldwide, is at an all-time high. I'd be a rich man if I had 25 cents for every time I've commented about the bottomless pit of G, D, L, I, E, A, those were all prefixes, and other countries that call me during a European opening. Thus, from this perspective, aggressively calling CQ is usually a sensible operating strategy. Secondly, while the top tier of stations has maintained its leadership in antenna hardware, the second tier has been hard at work, too. It used to be that only the very elite had use of stacked high band beams and other large antennas. Now, while it's hardly a majority, it's no longer that uncommon to run into station after station, especially in the United States, using antenna hardware that's larger than a tri-bander on a rooftop. The point is that while station X may still be 15 dB weaker than a W3LPL or K3LR, it is still transmitting a dominant signal that can take good advantage of a CQing operating strategy. The third contributor to this proliferation of CQers and contests is the use of the second radio by single operators. In the old days, as we used to say, you had to make some tough decisions about band choices as a single operator with only one radio. For example, should I call CQ on 20 meters with the intent of establishing a good clear frequency at the beginning of an opening to Europe, Japan? Or should I stay on the low bands for another 20 minutes and pick up some of those juicy 5W, VK6, FK8, CE, UA1 multipliers on 40 and 80 meters? With the use of a second radio, as I've described in the past, you can have the best of both worlds. After all, as a single operator, you don't have the limitation of the 10-minute rule or band change restrictions that multi-single operations have to contend with. You can CQ to your heart's content on 20 meters working stations at 20-30 QSOs per hour, for example, while mounting a determined multiplier search on the second radio. The result is maximized score and the creation of yet another tier of CQers on the board. Lastly, and I'm sure there are even more examples, competitors outside of North America have jumped on the CQing bandwagon as well. For at least the last 25 years, the bands have always been filled with louder overseas station running Ws, that's the eastern half of the United States, at a feverish clip. In recent years, they have been joined by a new second level of stations that have found CQing to be an effective operating strategy by virtue of 1. Improved station hardware, 2. Increased contesting experience, and 3. Rising participation by North Americans. This is especially noticeable with the JAs, that's the Japanese stations, in some European areas. So what is the point of all this rhetoric? I think a fair question to consider is there too much CQing in today's world of contesting? And is there anything we should do about it? While thinking about this topic, my first reaction was to put much of the blame on the level of sunspot activity. It's only natural that this topic becomes an issue of contention when everyone is forced into a 300-plus kilohertz band on the only useful daytime band, 20 meters. However, if you think about it, we have been dealing with this issue even during the last sunspot cycle peak. I can still vividly recall operating on 10 meters above 28850 kilohertz, not because I wanted to be there, but because the band was so crowded that it was simply the first usable spot I could find. Also, the issue of CQing is not simply limited to single sideband. A little introspective thought can yield similar comparisons on CW, Morse code, as well. Well, just to set your mind at ease, if it even needs to be, I'm hardly suggesting that we need to change contest rules to put a governor on the use of CQing in contests. What I am asking this month is for contesters to continue to keep this topic at the forefront of their minds and think about it in a little more depth as we operate. Remember, excessive CQing has implications beyond the contest community. A non-contester listening to a station calling CQ ineffectively can build a pretty strong case for spectrum misuse if you look at it from his or her perspective. As contesters, we need to continually be sensitive to that point. I hope you've been surviving the winter season and are making plans for fun antenna projects in the spring and summer, just around the corner, at least those of you in the north. This year will be the year we start our outside activities in April and not October, right? Right? Well, we can dream. See you in the next contest. 73 John, K1, AR. Let's go now to the DX column. The author here is Carl Smith, call N4AA, November 4, Alpha, Alpha. He titles this whole piece, 5-Band WAZ That's Worked All Zones, and the call sign N5PTH. Well, now 2009 sure gave the eastern USA a cool goodbye. Sub-freezing temperatures and heavy snow kept a lot of folks at home for Christmas and extended through New Year's. Even in mid-January, as I write this, it is very cold, well into the sunshine state of Florida. It's hard to comprehend freezing temperatures at Disney World in Orlando. I sure hope they are able to save the citrus crops. If you couldn't get out to see friends and relatives over the holidays, you probably spent time on the air, if you had power. That is, I lost mine for 3 full days. Propagation on the low bands was far more favorable than the weather. So, your on-the-air time would have been well spent. A good story came along concerning the low bands, and I'd like to share it with you, or part of it here, as much as time will allow. You might get some ideas of your own. Here is what Gary, N5PHT, in Texas, had to say following his completion of the requirements for CQ's 5-band Worked All Zones Award. My first WAZ award was the 20-meter single sideband awarded in 1993. I've been active on and off since then, but my active DX chasing started about 10 years ago. I got it down to meeting only 4 zones, all on 80 meters. But I had no success working them after many tries. I finally decided the simplest antenna I could put together with a little bit of gain on 80 meters would be a 1/4 wave sloper hanging off my 80-foot tower. I thought about the direction of the last 4 zones needed. Well, it turned out they all are fairly close together from North Texas. I realized my hit list spread was only from about 355 degrees, that's zone 18, to about 20 degrees, zone 21, with zones 22 and 17 tucked in between. I reasoned that a simple wire, 1/4 wave sloper would be a good bet aimed at about 5 degrees, and it would easily cover the targeted zone. Simple it was, too, just 1/4 wave of wire sloping at about a 45-degree angle from the tower, with the lower end about 10 feet off the ground, to prevent accidental contact. I fed the top end with coax, bonding the outer shield to the tower leg. The rig isn't anything out of this world either. I had an ICOM 746, but had upgraded to a 746 Pro a few years ago. It feeds an Armeritron ALS600 with about 500 watts output. On November 27, 2009, Nodir EY8MM gave me zone 17. Zone 18 was provided by Alex UA9YAB on December 16th in 09. Then only 5 days later came zone 22 via Nelson 4S7NE. I had to use registered mail. But what is 10 bucks postage for number 199? And the best was left for last. I had been emailing and trying some skeds with a few stations for my last zone, 21, including with Hammond, 9K2HN, with no luck. Hammond has a 2-element opti beam on 80 meters, so that gave me some hope. We tried, and zipped. Then during the last few hours of 2009, I received a call on my cell phone from Good Morning from Kuwait City. And it was none other than Hammond. He said, "Hope you are near your radio." I said something like, "I will be in a half a second." Well, we're almost perfect gray line at both locations and traded a nice 599 each way, and number 200 was in the bag. Thus, 5B Worked All Zones started with my initial award of 180 zones. That was certificate number 1514 issued on September 6, 2006, and ended a little over 3 years later, completing those last 20 zones. And this proud operator signed at 73DE Gary N5PHD. The article goes on about the solar flux. I just have to mention the solar flux. Here it is, mid-January, and the flux number has risen to the low 90s. I can't remember that last time I saw the flux at 90. It's been a long time. Therefore, the upcoming contest should be interesting. Could we see some propagation on 10 meters? That would be significant, and we need to be listening. Maybe talking would be better to see if there is anyone else doing the same. Contests seem to be the place to look for DX in late February and on through March. There are a few operations scheduled, but most of these are related to contesting. Now a note about postal rates and QSLing. An increase in Canadian postal rates increased post office box rental rates in Italy, and talk of another rate increase from the U.S. Postal Service. What else is new? It just continues to cost more to use the postal services no matter where you are. 2 years ago, my P.O. Box rental went from under $100 to $180 per year. Yes, I do have a large box because we need a large box. But the rate increasing nearly 50% over 2 years was almost enough for me to drop mine. I have not done so because it is convenient and we live in an area where a box on the roadside is required, and that service has proved to be unreliable for several reasons. So what, you say? I'm getting there, QSLing, and I talked about it last month. With the latest rate increases, I thought I'd touch on it again. If you are not using ARRL's logbook of the world, that's called LOTW or EQSL, you really need to take a long, hard look at getting there. If you are collecting paper, that is to say the QSL postcards, it probably isn't for you. But if you want confirmations, you need to be using Logbook of the World. Recently, I had an interesting telephone conversation. A reader commented that he had about given up on DXing with all of the intentional interference and general discourteous operation by so many. However, after taking a look at the whole subject, he has taken an attitude, quote, I don't care if I get a card. I don't plan to apply for any awards. If I don't like what a DX station is doing, I just turn the knob. It doesn't matter anymore if I have worked his country or not. I just like the competition of the pileup and making the contact. I worked the station recently, and he had my call wrong. I don't even care. I worked him. I put him in my log. And to me, that's all that counts. Close quote. Sometimes I feel like doing that myself. Perhaps I'll have more DX to talk about next time. But for now, all I can offer is to enjoy the chase and remember to have fun doing it. 73 Carl, N4AA. Here's a quick review of CQ history from 1945 to 1910, their 65th year. 1957-1961, dawn of the space age and record sunspot numbers. 1957, Sputnik launched by USSR, ushering in the space age. Hams among first to receive transmissions from the satellite. Solar cycle 19 reaches peak, highest on record, resulting in unparalleled DXing opportunities. Collins introduces its first transceiver, the KWN-1. Slow-scan television invented. 1958, continued peak of cycle 19, integrated circuit invented, 11-meter ham band relocations to newly created citizen band. Year 1959, RCA promotes new Vistors to hams in effort to hold off onslaught of transistors. Don Stoner, W6TNS, famously poses the question in his CQ semiconductors column, does anyone have a spare rocket for orbiting purposes? Leading directly to the birth of Project Oscar and the launch of the first amateur satellite 2 years later. The year 1960, first amateur radio EME, that's Earth, Moon, Earth, contact between W6HB and W1BU. 73 magazine begins publication. General Conference on Weights and Measures adopts the Hertz, HZ, as the standard unit of frequency. 1961, Oscar 1, orbiting satellite carrying amateur radio, launched. The first non-governmental satellite ever placed in orbit. It was a transmit-only satellite sending primitive telemetry, high HI, in Morse code on 2 meters, with speed varying with the satellite's temperature. Well, that's a flash-bang review, folks. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My location, QTH, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts, down near Buzzards Bay in good old Cape Cod. I'm reading for you CQ Magazine for the month of March 2010. CQ is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. You can reach Handy Hams at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. The website, great website, always being updated on a daily basis. It's www.handyham.org, and handyham is always spelled H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, lowercase, www.handyham.org. Thanks again for listening along with me today. Bob Zeta, 73.